So I walk into the nurse's clinic, and they are looking at me like I have three heads, and I'm like so excited, my first job, and they sat me down, and this is Barbara McGinnis, by the way, who was the head nurse, after whom we've now named our program. But she looked at me along with the other nurses and said, look, we've been doing this for about 20 years without the help of doctors or hospitals, thank you very much. So if you sit down, we'll show you what to do. Remember, I'm coming from the ICU thinking I'm really good, and I'm going in and sitting down. And so I had to, for 2 months, soak feet. This is the oldest picture I have. And it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. But Barbara took away my stethoscope, said, you can't be a doctor for these 2 months. You're just going to have to be an apprentice, and we'll show you what to do. And what she and the other nurses were explaining very carefully, or very gently, I guess, was that I had been trained where you have to see people fast. If I wasn't seeing five or six people in an hour, someone's knocking on the door saying, can I help you, move on, what's going on? And Barbara's point, along with the other nurses, was that nothing changes in the lives of people who have been so downtrodden by poverty and all of that without taking time to be present and to set up a relationship. And if there's anything in our training that is worked on against, you know, that is the opposite of that, it's having time to build those kinds of relationships. Only time does that, but not very much happens in 10 or 15 minutes in an exam office. So I soaked this man's feet, just to give you the example and reason I love this picture. And he had been in the emergency room. I had seen him a zillion times at Mass General's emergency room, and we knew him in the chart as a paranoid schizophrenic who was, quote, treatment resistant. And he had logged innumerable things where he'd been brought in by EMS. So I started soaking his feet. He never said anything to me. He looked at me always with that wry smile. His legs were always swollen. He was always getting infections where the skin had broken down from his terrible venous stasis. And one night after about a month, he looked down at me and he said, what the hell are you doing soaking feet? First words to me, okay? What the hell are you doing soaking feet? He said, I thought you were a doctor. And so I was thinking, you know, finally someone acknowledges I'm a doctor. And it turns out to be someone who has a significant thought disorder, right? So, but what was magic about it was a few nights later, oh, I told him, by the way, I do whatever the nurses tell me. That's my role. And he, a couple nights later, he came in and he said, Doc, I can't sleep. Can you help me sleep? Okay. And as you might suspect, he finally had sort of gotten enough used to me enough that I was now part of the system, not there to take him away, not there to tell him what to do. The other interesting thing about the foot soak, even though it has all sorts of biblical sense, what I learned on that is it reverses the power relationship. You know, I'm at the feet and he's in charge. And it's a long way away from personal space. And Barbara didn't want me to have a stethoscope where I'd be up in somebody's face listening to their heart or listening to their lungs. And it was brilliant. I just did not understand at the time how brilliant it really was. And it was comforting to someone who was spending most of his day walking around and sitting down and having their feet soaked. It was really remarkable. I remember walking into the clinic, and around the waiting room of the clinic, there were probably 12, this was on the men's side, the women's side had exactly the same thing. There'd be 12 men sitting in the chairs around, thing, all soaking their feet, and the nurses just talking to them like everything was normal. And everyone was called by their name. There was no, you know, everyone was Mr. So-and-so. It was very dignified and really very cool. Way different than what I had learned. I wanted to sort of salute those of you who are public health nurses, particularly Barbara McGinnis was a public health nurse assigned to Pine Street Inn. She was a TB public health nurse from the state. But the nurse's clinic at Pine Street Inn, in the fall that I started in July, and this was in the fall, was on the cover of the American Journal of Nursing. It was the only independent licensed nurses' clinic in the country at the time, and a fabulous place to learn basically everything I learned to in homelessness. But also, I had to learn that in the world of social justice, I had to learn that I was coming out of an academic ivory tower with no experience of what was going on, thinking I knew what was going on. I had arranged every friend I knew to volunteer. We set up this elaborate system of making sure the dermatologists and the cardiologists, everybody was all ready to do a night a week or a night a month, whatever it was. And we had it all set up without talking to the nurses, not talking to anybody. And then it turned out that coalition that my chief of medicine had been part of had included homeless people and homeless advocates, many of whom Anna would remember and know well. And they came up with, they were very keen about how our program should look. So all that I'm going to show you is what they came up with, not what we came up with. And they wanted continuity of care. And they thought fragmentation was the true F word in this world. That everyone was homeless had fragmented care. There was no continuity of care. And the last thing they wanted us to do was duplicate fragmentation in our own system. And they wanted it from Shelter and Street right through to the hospital, okay? Because that's where they had perceived most homeless people were getting their care. And so to leave the hospitals out of this was going to be to fragment their care. The second thing is they wanted teams. And I saw it as multidisciplinary teams, but in fact, in those days, they were thinking of making sure the doctor worked with a nurse practitioner and a social worker. That was their team. And it was all about continuity. So they were afraid if I came and spent a year, got to know people, and they opened up, and then I went on to my fellowship, I was leaving people left behind. They hated that idea of people coming out, spending 6 weeks or 6 months or a year doing good work and then going on and doing their profession. So the challenge that they threw to us was, how do you make this a career that you dig in and you commit yourself to the people that, whose feet you've been soaking and stick with them, which was not at all what I was planning on doing. Just so you know, it was a crisis for me. The last thing they did was say respite care. But let me show you. This is a group of a later picture. So we were required from the beginning, and this is our consumer advisory board. I wish we had a better word for it. But the people who we serve have always been involved in the governance of our program, which is something very different than what I was used to at the hospital. The hospital board of directors is way different, okay? So in our board of directors to this day, by the way, 7 of the 15 people are people who are currently homeless, and they are literally our bosses. They hire and fire us, and it has been the best thing going. I'll give you a great example. When they first were getting together and felt the importance of representing the people we serve, somebody said, you have to be clean and sober to be part of the board, and we weren't involved in this. This is them deciding for themselves. And one person who was in AA said, absolutely, how else can you do it? And another person who was still struggling with a pretty active heroin abuse said, wait a minute, if half or more of the people we're serving here are still struggling, why can't they be involved in the thing? So the rule is that you do not have to be clean and sober to be on the board, but you do have to come to the meetings, not high and not. And that was the rule they came up with. So for many years, 2 of our board members have been actively struggling with a heroin addiction. And believe me, when we come to structure up our services that way, they are the best input we have. Okay, so it's really sort of interesting. But they also got pretty hard-assed on us, okay? And they said, this is 1984, okay? They were so mistrustful of us, the health system and the doctors, primarily the hospitals and the doctors, that they went to Hale & Dorr, a big legal firm in Boston, and said, these are the things we're requiring of the mayor. At the time it was Mayor Flynn. If we will go along with this grant, and Mayor Flynn really wanted the grant to help do better health care for homeless people. But they wanted to look at this as an issue of social justice and not charity. I can still remember Kip Tiernan, who founded Rosie's Place, which is the oldest women's shelter in the country, saying, and I can remember she was on our board of directors, and I don't remember that she was saying, you know, when you throw people, charity is when you throw people scraps from the table, and justice is when you give them a seat at the table. And so she wanted nothing to do with charity. So we couldn't use any volunteers. So that whole system I had set up in my mind was out. Okay, we also couldn't use students, interestingly, because they thought students, this was a reversal from the whole medical thing, they thought students were going to be sent out to learn on homeless people. They didn't want to be the people that were learned on. They wanted to empower them. And they made us, for example, like as a doctor, I had to maintain my connection in the hospital. I had to stay credentialed at Mass General and at Boston City Hospital in those days and still take care of people in the hospital. So when people got sick, we would still take care of them there. So that was part of the continuity. But all of that came out of the community, okay? It didn't come out of us. There are other things that I'm going to skip over. Then a couple things happened to me that I'd love to share with you, and I think my time is probably truncated, so I've got to be a little careful here. But 2 things happened, and I'm not going to show you the slides. In 1985, when I started working in the shelter, we had an outbreak of pulmonary tuberculosis, 100 cases of active pulmonary tuberculosis in the one shelter. Okay, and it turned out to be what all of you will know as an MDR, a multi-drug resistant organism. It's actually the first one that CDC recorded in our country in modern times. And it was just before the AIDS epidemic hit. So these were 100 people, none of whom were immunocompromised, all INH and strep resistant. Each one required 4 medications for every day for 18 months in those days to treat. So we learned right away that, you know, I was a doctor thinking I was dealing one-on-one, and I was in the middle of a public health nightmare. And I'm going to just show you, this, by the way, is a picture of Barbara McGinnis, who is a TB nurse, and Yoshiko Van, who is a nurse practitioner. I've always worked in a team with a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant and a social worker. And Yoshiko and I worked together for 10 years with Mark. And that's Barbara on the right with all our x-rays in there. And what we learned is the only way we could take care of these people was to go out and find them. And we would work with, that's Ursula, the public health nurse from the state, and Mark, who's the caseworker on our team. They would get on their bikes every day and find people and give them medication. And for those of you who know Paul Farmer and Jim Kim, this was in Boston, maybe less than a mile from the hospital, okay? And it was like a third world TB outbreak from which they learned DOT, basically, which they then applied in Peru and in Rwanda. So when I think of my career and the blessings we've had, I was in school with Paul, and he's gone and changed the world, basically. And I laugh when I'm with him, I've gotten exactly 1 mile from medical school, and that's my entire 30 years, okay? But there are more similarities, believe it or not, than differences. The other thing I wanted to share with you is respite care, which I didn't even know what it was. There is a respite care and a Medicare, by the way, if any of you deal with Medicare. This is respite care for homeless people. And we were given 25 beds at the corner of a shelter called a Shattuck shelter. It was a 100-bed open shelter. We had 25 beds in the corner. And our mandate, which we were trying to figure out, this is September of 1985. At the time, there were no other respite programs in the country. And we were supposed to take care of people who were too sick to be didn't need to be in the hospital anymore, but were way too sick to be in the shelters and wandering the streets all day. And in our town, the shelters, while all of them are wet except for one, meaning you can come in drunk or high, you can't stay there during the day. You have to leave at 6 or 6:30 in the morning and can't come back in until 4 in the afternoon. So if you're really sick just out of the hospital, that's a tough thing to do. And in Boston, we have exactly 2 public bathrooms that you can get to, so there's another issue with justice on that one. But this was our sleepy little respite program in 1985. And for those of you who might have been around then, the example I remember as a senior resident at Mass General in 1985, if you came in for your open heart surgery, your CABG, your average length of stay was 6 weeks. That's at Mass General. Okay, it's 3.2 days now or something like that. If you had a hernia surgery, it would be an average length of stay of 5 to 7 days in the hospital. Gallbladder was 7 days. Those are now outpatient procedures. Okay, so when you think of the migration of healthcare, healthcare going from the real acute setting to the outpatient and home setting, homeless people got lost in that, and respite programs became the finger in the dike trying to help out. So as time has gone on, so TB was out going on. Then the second thing that happened in September of 1985 is we had our first case of AIDS in the homeless shelters community. I had, in the hospital when I was an intern, I actually took care of our first case of AIDS at Mass General. That was 1982. And when I got to the shelter, I was really surprised the epidemic had not gotten to that community as of yet. But we were just sitting on the precipice when all of a sudden, within about 3 months, we had 10 and then 20 and then about 100 homeless people who had really terrible opportunistic infections from AIDS. We didn't have the test yet, so we were still waiting for people to get declared. And that took up inordinate amounts of time. Our weeks used to be 100 to 110 hours trying to keep up with TB and AIDS. By the way, just as a little plug for ourselves, we've been fortunate in Boston through the help of a lot of people. That's our respite program now, which is called the Barbara McGinnis House, by the way, after Barbara, who was our public health nurse, that taught us everything. But it's 104 beds of inpatient step-down care for homeless people who are either coming out of the hospital, those who are having surgery that need pre- and post-operative care, those on chemotherapy and radiation. And we've also learned that we have to do an awful lot of end-of-life care, which I'm truncating here. But these are 2 men in the same room, one 84, the other 37, both from different sides of the line, who were dying together. And it was a really interesting learning experience for all of us to sort of take care of people who are dying, who have really lost everything. And this woman, who I would probably just want to share with you as one quick story, is that she lived on the streets of Boston down in the finance district, and she used to live on a stoop, and the way she would keep you away was to just keep everything as smelly and dirty as she possibly could. She would wear the worst clothing, leave all of her junk around, and that was her defense against anyone coming in to talk to her. And she eventually got hepatitis C from a blood transfusion and didn't stop drinking and went on to get full-blown cirrhosis. But for the transplant surgeons at Mass General to do her life-saving, at that time, surgery, she had to prove 6 months of residential stability and 6 months of being clean and sober. So our respite program is using an average stay of about 2 weeks to a month. It's an acute medical facility, which, by the way, is funded by Medicaid in Massachusetts, which is an interesting other story. We kept her there for 6 months so we could document for the surgeons that she was doing well. And she turned out to be the most delightful, wonderful human being you could imagine. But she called me in just as she got to the top of the list and said, "Well, I take a picture." This is actually the first picture of a face of a homeless person I actually ever took. And she got all dressed up. You probably can't appreciate it, but she has lipstick on, and she has fingernail polish on. She has some shoes, nice shoes on, a dress. She even put flowers in a little styrofoam cup to put by her bedside table and asked me to take that picture. And I brought it back to her, and I gave it to her in a little, you know, printed it out and gave it to her in a little 5x7 thing or something. And I said, so what's going on in your mind? And she said, which I still think about all the time, she said, well, look, you know, I've got to have this big surgery, and I'm not sure I'm going to make it through it or not. He said, but the real truth is I have two daughters. Last I saw them, they were 4 and 5 years old. They're now in their early 30s, but I don't know where they are or what's going on. But should they ever want to find what their mother looked like, I want to be sure there was a picture of me looking at least presentable so that they would have that. Okay. And I started thinking, my God, this experience of illness and suffering when you've lost everything, you don't even know where your kids are, when your family has, for whatever reasons, no longer can handle you being around. Dying alone like that is really horrible. I spent some time in Haiti, and I remember how awful the poverty was, but you know what? There was a joy in the poverty that you know, a music in the poverty that made me feel at least people were dying with family around, with comforted by people around. But in America, in our inner cities, it's a lonely poverty, and it's really frightening as you see it. I'm looking for the sign. Am I okay on time here, you guys? I'm so sorry. Should I stop here?
Right now, no. Okay. It's 12 o'clock right now. I learned yesterday from Mary to give you a whole session. We took 10 minutes at the end after the last speaker to offer people opportunities to talk and to discuss and ask questions. So don't take long, but we'll go over.
I could stop right here. I was going to share what I was going to share with you next, but I can easily pass for questions, is that my own clinical life now, or at least for many years, has been taking care of those people who live on the streets, as Anna knows well. In Boston, we have a shelter bed for everybody. It's about 3,200 shelter beds. Remember, I'm talking, we're at the bottom of the pile now, okay, so just think of that. But the people who live on the streets are those people who, for whatever reasons, can't handle going into a shelter. And it's not because they've been drinking or doing drugs or anything, because all the shelters will let you in. So it's a very complicated subgroup of the homeless population. I was going to share with you, that's the panel of patients that I take care of with the team, about 300 of whom now have been housed through Housing First programs. And we're doing just what Anna taught us to do a long time ago, is spending a lot of our time doing home visits as a team with the mental health person and the nurse and the doctor together. And it's fabulous, but I'll talk about that at some other time. But thank you. I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
I know that some of you probably have to go, but let us entertain just a few questions. I know many of you are public health nurses are going to the section luncheon. So if anyone would have a quick question for any of our panelists, if not, you might want to catch them at the end and talk with them individually. Quick questions? Any? Okay, thank you very much.